Matthew chapter 10, verse 34. Do not suppose that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but sword. I have come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be the members of his own household. Anyone who loves his mother or father more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And anyone who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. He who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives the one who sent me. Anyone who receives a prophet because he is a prophet will receive a prophet's reward. And anyone who receives a righteous man because he is a righteous man will receive a righteous man's reward. And if anyone gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones because he is my disciple, I tell you the truth, he will certainly not lose his reward.
Friends of us recently gave us a little book. I meant to bring it, but forgot it in the rush of the morning. And it's a book called Big Bites, Big Prayers, something like that. But what it is it's 40 days of prayers or praying with your children for mission around the world. And it gives you a country to pray for, a particular topic to pray with your children over the 40 days. It's a great book. It kind of tarries well with what we're doing at the moment in our morning series and evening series on mission. I'll get a few copies for folks to be able to buy. It's only about £4 a book. I highly recommend it. But one of the stories this week, or one of the things that we're to pray for, was it was telling us about the country of North Korea. North Korea is the worst country to live in as a believer. It is where the greatest persecution of believers takes place. And yet there are still 335,000 believers in that land. But one of the things that it told us, which was striking, was that parents do not tell their children about Jesus or share that they are a believer until the children are of an age to understand the dangers, to understand the costs. They don't want the risk of a child just blurting out at the wrong time in the wrong place. But more than that, they want the child to understand that to follow Jesus involves great cost, great danger, particularly in that land. And Jesus, as he comes to the end of Matthew 10, as he's kind of been teaching us on mission, wants to underline, as it were, there is a great cost to following me. He's been telling us about it. It's going to involve persecution. It's going to involve hardship. But of course, he's been saying to us as well, look, but you don't need to be afraid. As we saw the other week, our Heavenly Father loves us. He provides for us. But he wants us to make sure, no, friends, there is a cost. But there is also a great reward. He wants his disciples to be realistic, though, about what it means to follow him, just like the parents in North Korea. And so Jesus wants us to be clear in these final few verses. And he begins by, well, making sure that we understand his mission. So if you're going to follow Jesus, you have to be clear about Jesus' mission. And so the first thing is we begin to think about this whole area of what it's going to mean to costly to follow him in this area and the reward. The first thing we need to know is this: be clear on Jesus' mission, verse 34. Have a look. Jesus says to his disciples, verse 34, do not suppose that I have come to bring peace onto the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Now, we read this and we think, whoa, 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 hold on. Didn't I learn at Christmas? It's peace on earth, goodwill to men, heart the herald angels sing. And most Jews at the time thought that when Jesus was on earth, he would expel the occupying Roman army, that he would lead the nation to victory, he would inaugurate a reign of peace and prosperity. And then there was plenty of Old Testament quotations that kind of supported that. After all, he was to be the Prince of Peace. And many think today still that he came to bring peace to earth now. And as such, many think that Christianity has failed. Because if Christianity has been around for 2,000 years and yet there's still so much suffering and war and injustice in the world, as well as just the conflicts in family life, surely Jesus' claim to be Prince of Peace is bogus. He's failed. But here's the thing, Jesus never said that at his first coming, suddenly all wars would cease, all arguments in home would end, and peace would just reign on this planet. Oh, that is to come. We can be sure of that. New heavens, new earth, peace is coming. There will be no wars, there will be that time to come. But that's not what he said would happen in his first coming. In fact, Jesus says it's the opposite. Verse 34, it's not peace, but a sword. Now, how does that fit with the Prince of Peace and the angels' words to the shepherds on that first Christmas? Well, the peace that Jesus came to bring was peace with God through forgiveness of sins. And that was going to cost him his life on a cross to bring that about. That those who trusted him would have peace, relationship, friendship with God once more. And in truth, there is no greater peace that a human being can have than to have peace with God. But here's the thing. In order for sinners and rebels, people like you and me, to accept that, to receive that peace, we're going to have to surrender our wills. We're going to have to give up our ways, and we're going to have to start doing things God's way, and we're going to have to start trusting and following Christ. And the truth is, humanly, we all naturally resist that and oppose that. Now, in God's mercy, some, many of us here, have surrendered our lives, our wills to him, and we're seeking to follow Christ as Lord. We're Christians. But many don't, and will not, and will continually resist God and his purposes. And this will bring division and conflict, a sword. So you see, the picture of sword here is not so much of fighting, it's much more the idea of division. You see, Jesus is coming, his bringing peace with God will mean there will be a division, a conflict between those who surrender their lives and follow Christ and those who do not, who oppose him, who resist him, who stand against Christ and his people. Jesus already stated that, verse 22. He already said, you will be hated by everyone because of me. His coming brings this conflict, brings this division, because people choose sides. Either they'll be on Christ's side, trusting and following him, or they will oppose him. See, the Bible only really sees two groups of people. Those who are Christ's and those who are not. And between those groups, says Jesus, will be conflict, will be division. It doesn't surprise us. We've seen this before over the last few weeks. Think of Paul's words in Ephesians 2. He's very clear. Those who do not follow Christ follow the prince of this world. They follow Satan. If they're following Satan, they're going to hate Christ and they're going to hate his people. There's division. There's conflict between these two groups of people. And Jesus says his first coming will bring about this kind of division. And he spells out exactly what this will look like. He says, he spells out what this will mean in practice. He says, look, secondly, it will mean painful separation from loved ones. Painful separation from loved ones, verse 35 to 37. See what Jesus says? Verse 35, for I've come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be the members of his own household. Anyone who loves their father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves their son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Now again, we read these words, and again, at first sounding, they sound harsh. In fact, Luke's account's even harsher. It says, speaks of hating one's mother and father. Hating one's son and daughter is not worthy of me. So it's not a surprise many have stumbled over these words, but we need to understand what Jesus is saying. And he's simply saying this: I must be first in your affections and your emotions. I must come first. If you're going to follow me, I must be number one. See, we're called to turn our backs on all other rivals. He must be first. Now look, such a demand is neither unreasonable or unusual. If you join up to the army, you turn your back on civilian life. If you sign a contract to become an employee of a firm, you cannot be employed by someone else. If you get married, you say, I'm forsaking all others, I'll stick with you for life. Now, you might say it a little bit nicer than that, but that's what you're saying, isn't it? And so when Jesus claims allegiance to him, first and foremost, it's not unreasonable and it's not unusual. But you see, what happens when our decision to follow Jesus, put him first, is then not shared by those who are nearest and dearest to us? Well, then, says Jesus, there's going to be a sore, there's going to be division in the family. In that sense, he says, I've come to turn a man against his father. And Jesus uses the most significant or relationships he could to make this point. In the Jewish culture, loyalty to one's father, head of the household, was one of those most deep-seated convictions governing family life. Similarly, between a mother and a daughter. See, a mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law, if they were at loggerheads, the daughter-in-law would be hugely lonely, isolated, because she'd have been brought into the husband's family. And Jesus kind of underlines it when he says, verse 88, look, to have enemies in your household, it's the very last place you would expect. Jesus, costly, it's painful. When people begin to start saying, no, Jesus is number one. And you can imagine how fathers and mothers begin to say, well, surely I should be first, or I should be first. Jesus says, no, I need to be number one. And so Jesus says that these divisions will happen as a result of his coming. And it's not that he came to destroy family relationships, far from it. But his coming into anyone's life inevitably separates them from those who do not respond to Christ's claims, who do not acknowledge his lordship, his kingship. Jesus arouses strong feelings both in the believers and the non-believers. He's a Marmite-type figure. You either love him or you hate him. And that kind of emotion then spills into family life, into those relationships dearest to us. And when it happens, it's always very hard to take. And I know that some of you, many of you, regularly experience and know this pain in your family settings. So for some here, it's right there in your immediate family every day, be it your spouse, your children. Maybe it's your parents if you're still living at home. For others of us, it comes from our wider families, siblings, maybe parents from grown-up children, aunts and uncles, grandchildren. And we feel this division, this tension. And it will work itself out in different ways. Maybe if you're in the family context, it's going to come with maybe just how you're raising the children. It's going to come just over whether how much time you're spending at church or community group or serving in the life of the church. It's going to come over the use of your money. It's going to just come just the behavior, things that they want to do that you just feel uncomfortable doing because there's so much of the world. And there's just going to be this tension. I know folks where non-Christian parents just cannot grasp why their children, who they educated, are turning down bright career prospects to go and kind of bury themselves in a remote part of the world or lead a church in the UK. And some have been cut off, such as the disappointment that the parents feel. See, there's this tension that exists. Sometimes it's verbalized. Sometimes it just results in us being kind of left out of family gatherings or just constantly feeling that we're letting the family down. And we know the reason. We know the reason is because we're Christ's. And they're not. There's this sword. There's this division. In other parts of the world, to follow Christ literally means to be kicked out of your family. In preparation, I read of 71, just in the last few months, who converted from Islam, who has said, I'm going to follow Christ and make him number one, and it cost them their whole family. They were just kicked out, shunned. 71 just left with all that they had on their backs, as it were. All because they followed Christ. Their parents, their siblings, their wider families, just not wanting anything to do with them because they follow Jesus. And Jesus says that's part of the cost. It's part of the cost of following me, of putting me first. There's going to be this division. But at those times when that tension arises, we need to remember with a heavy heart, verse 38, that anyone who loves their father, their mother, their son, their daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Now, what does Jesus mean by that? Well, again, it's far from being an invitation to destroy family relationships. No, Jesus is saying, look, if the world is ever going to believe that this gospel is actually true, that, look, I am the king, that I am the Lord, the rightful Lord of people's lives, then it's got to see that I am first. That it's my rightful position as Lord and King. And it's got to be seen even in those relationships that matter most to us. That actually they come after me, all those other relationships. I'm number one. Now we know that's hard to do. But you see, we need to ask God's help to do it. But it's one of the demands that Jesus can rightly make of us because he is the Lord. See, if I put anyone else before him, then practically I am denying his lordship and his kingship, and I am making an idol of another human being or of a relationship, no matter who they are or how close they are to me. I remember years ago being in a Christianity Explore type meeting, and we were looking at these words, and one of the seekers there just could not get over this whole idea, what Jesus is going to come first. How can I say to my husband that I love Jesus more than him? And it was a barrier just to her coming to faith. It's the cost. But here's the key thing. And here's the thing, probably because I didn't explain it well, that this lady in the course all those years ago did not get, that actually, I love my family best by loving Christ more. I love my family best by loving Christ more. Because firstly, they see a lived out, beautiful, ordinary Christian life. Do you remember what Peter writes in 1 Peter 3? As he writes to believing wives who are married to unbelieving husbands, he says, in effect, just live it out. Live it out that you will win them over. You will win over your non-believing husbands. And I think that principle applies to other relationships. Now, it's not to say that we don't tell them the gospel. We need to do that. But they have to see it lived. They have to see the difference it makes for Jesus to be number one in our lives. They have to see the reality. They have to see the cost. And as they see, do you see, as we love them in that way, as we seek to put Jesus first, as we seek to live for him, we're seeking to be witnesses to them. And there is nothing that we can do that is greater than seeking to tell our families and live to them in that way that they might see Christ. Do you see, we love them best by loving Christ more. But you see, secondly as well, not only do we witness, but by living for Christ, we'll love them better. Because it will make me a better husband or wife, or a better father or mother, or a better son or daughter, or a better brother or sister, or a better niece or nephew, or a better grandchild. Because Jesus commands me to love God and love my neighbor. And if I'm loving Jesus right, I can't help but seek to love my neighbors. And my immediate neighbor is my family. And Jesus says, look, the way you love is you lay down your life. Biblical love means you love well. You put them first in many ways. You seek to love them and put them before yourself. Not before Christ, but before you. And you love them. And much of what Jesus commands us to do in love doesn't ever contradict, but only enhances what it means to be a good husband or a good wife or a good son or a good daughter or a good father or a good mother. So yes, we're to put Christ first. And yes, it might bring tension and division. And you will feel it. I feel it in my family. But I'll also, with God's help, love my family better as well. Jesus is not to say that when we do all of that, they'll suddenly all come to Christ. It's still a work of the Spirit in their lives. And many of us know that reality. But friends, this tension is real. The division will be there. But we love them best by loving Christ more. So that's the first cost. There'll be painful separation from loved ones. The second cost is from the world. Costly separation from the world. Verse 38. Costly separation from the world. See what Jesus says? Whoever does not take up their cross and follow me is not worthy of me. To be Jesus' disciples means taking up our cross and laying down our lives. Now, in our culture, the cross has been hugely romanticized. You know, it's something we wear around our necks. It's something that just adorns church buildings. People even put it in their church logos. It has become, in many ways, just an affectionate symbol, understandably. Has great significance for us. But in Jesus' day, if you were carrying a cross, it meant you had no future. It meant you had no control over your own circumstances. There was no way out. It was the mark of being in a cul-de-sac with death at the end. It was the punishment that was set aside for the criminal, the terrorist. And Jesus says, look, to follow me will be to take up your cross. In other words, you lay down your life, your will, and you surrender them to him. And Jesus says, only such a disciple is worthy of me. To be unwilling to make that sort of commitment to Jesus and the gospel is to disqualify myself from the name of disciple. It's to be, as one writer puts it, a chocolate soldier rather than a true disciple. See, a true disciple will be willing to lay down their life in light of what Christ has done for us. See, for Christ took up his cross. He laid down his life. He allowed his blood to be shed that he might bear the punishment that we rightly deserved, that we might go free, that we might have peace with God, be friends with him. And the true disciple, the true disciple is not one who just turns up to church on a Sunday. The true disciple is not one who just says, you know, I believe in a bloke called Jesus and I kind of label myself with that label Christian. The true disciple is one who believes Jesus truly has laid down his life for them, bearing the punishment that they deserve for their rebellion, for turning their backs on God, and that in his death he brought them peace with God. And that as such, Jesus is their king and rightly claims that over them and over those who trust in him. such that they would then pick up their crosses and follow him, surrendering their will and their all to him and him alone. Now here's the question. Where are you? True disciple? Or just turning up? Now, for some of you, maybe it's just early days. You just begun to come along to church and you just begin to hear about Jesus and what it is to follow him and know him and just carry on finding out more about what it means to be a follower of Jesus and why he has this right to be king and claim that over anyone. For others of you, you've been sitting on the fence for a long time. And friends, it's time to get in the game. And it's time to be a true disciple and to trust Christ and to let him be the Lord and King of your life and take up your cross and follow him. You can't put it off any longer. It's time to be a true disciple, to begin to really follow him. Not just turn up, but to say, you know what, Jesus is my King. He is number one. And I'm going to follow him for the remainder of my days. So will you? For others of us, we are disciples, we have been, and we are seeking to take up our cross, what we want to be, until, of course, Jesus begins to cross our plans, or he challenges my prejudice, or until he begins to call me to do things that I do not want to do. But you see, if I turn back at that point, how can I possibly claim to be a real disciple worthy of him? So what does it say to a watching world? Jesus' death's not that important. It's not that significant. It didn't really achieve that much. Look, because his followers, when the going gets tough, they give up. Taking up our crosses will mean surrendering our all. It might mean not being accepted by the in crowd at the school gate. In the workplace. It might mean that you're not invited to the best parties. It might mean that you're not spending large proportions of our income on material things. It might mean you're not taking that promotion, because if you did, you'd have less time for God and his service, as well as less time for the family that he has given you. It might mean moving to serve the gospel to another town, to another part of town, to another country, in order to follow Christ and proclaim the gospel. But real discipleship means living by Jesus' priorities, not mine. Following his ways, not the world's ways. Behaving as he would, not as the world would. It will mean laying down my life to do things his way, not my way. And friends, it will be costly. It will be costly because there will be times when you'll look on others and just wish, I wish I could spend my money like they do. I wish I could take that promotion. If only. But friends, at that point, we need to remember, it's worth it. It's worth following Jesus. See, Jesus follows, having kind of underlined the cost, told us of the division, the painful separation, the cost of separating from the world and being unlike the world. He finishes verse 39 to 42. That following Jesus is worth it now and for eternity. See, as Jesus finishes his instructions that he started in verse 5 and he's reminding them of the cost that's involved in following him, he finishes by making it very clear. It's worth it. It's a privilege. It's a sound investment. I don't know about you, but I hate trying to work out what to do, you know, regarding the future finances, pensions and ISAs. And over the last few months, because of the change in law, we're having to look at our pension and meet with financial advisor. And I actually don't know what he's saying most of the time. And he's trying to tell me this is a sound investment. I'm sure it is, but I don't know. I'm a pastor. What do I know about things like that on finances and pensions? So at times like this, I phone my dad or I phone Nigel, and they tell me whether it's a good thing to do or not, pretty much. But here's what I do know. To invest one's life in mission, in following Jesus, is a sound investment. With a guaranteed reward, and there's no risk, and there's no disappointment. Just see, look what Jesus says, verse 39. Whoever finds their life now will lose it. Follow the world, do what the world says, you'll lose it. Whoever loses their life for my sake will find it. Whoever gives up their life, takes up their cross, follows my priorities, says Jesus, put me and my cause first above our own desires and those of our nearest and dearest, and Jesus says, you will find life. You will find true life. You will find life with Jesus for all eternity. It will be worth it. Jesus, you're not really giving anything up because you're going to gain life with Jesus for all eternity. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a German pastor in the Second World War, was imprisoned for effectively being a Christian pastor because he sought to oppose and hinder Hitler. On Sunday, the 8th of April, 1945, a few months before the war would finish, he led a short service of worship. He'd hardly finished his last prayer when the door opened and two men in civilian clothes came in. Prisoner Bonhoeffer, get ready to come with us. And the words, come with us, had come for all prisoners to mean only one thing, the scaffold. And Bonhoeffer said this, this is the end. For me, the beginning of life. Here was a man who went to his human death, knowing, yep, this bit was over. But actually, it was the beginning of life. He took up his cross, knowing he would lose his life, but that ultimately he would find it with Jesus for all eternity. See, Jesus is no man's debtor. Whatever we give up for Jesus, we gain much more as his. In fact, every little act is rewarded. There is nothing that we do that's not seen by the Father. See what Jesus says in verses 40 to 42. Verse 40, anyone who welcomes or receives you receives me. Anyone who receives me receives the one who sent me. Then he goes on. Whoever receives, welcomes a prophet will receive a prophet's reward. Whoever receives, welcomes a righteous man as a righteous man will receive a righteous man's reward. And if anyone gives even a cup of cold water, the most simplest of kind acts, the smallest act that any human being can do for another human being, if you even give a cup of cold water to one of these little ones who is my disciples, Jesus says, truly I tell you, that person will certainly not lose their reward. Do you see what Jesus is saying? Receive these ones, welcome these ones, is in effect to receive, welcome Jesus. To welcome the prophet and the righteous person and the disciple is to accept their message, Jesus' message. And it's to do it as if you were welcoming, receiving Jesus himself. And what's striking throughout those three verses is that both the messenger, the one sent to proclaim the good news, and the one who receives that messenger and looks after them and cares for them, is both equally rewarded. Nothing we do, from sharing the gospel to opening our homes to giving a cup of water, Jesus does not see and does not reward. You can't outdo God. So even as we're sent on mission, yes, there's going to be cost. Yes, we will be hated. Yes, you will be persecuted. Yes, you might have to live with the tension of a divided family or worse, experience being rejected by your family. And yes, you might have to give up much of what the world offers and deems as good and successful. And yes, you might even have to give up your physical life, but it will be worth it. You'll gain eternal life, and Jesus says you will be rewarded. And note what else? Note the intimacy here between us and Jesus and the Father. As we go as his messengers, his disciples. It's interesting that the prophet, the righteous person, the disciple, that they're all equal in that sense. They're all sent. In other words, it's everyone, isn't it? We're all disciples who are sent to go and proclaim the message of Jesus. And when we do that, Jesus says, they receive you, they receive me. You're identified with Christ. And so therefore we don't need to be ashamed of the gospel. We don't need to apologize for its a message, because we represent the King of Kings. So that we can go anywhere in the world, hold our heads up high, because we are Jesus's. He is the King, the one who gives life, the one who rewards, the one who is with us. See the great encouragement that Jesus is saying right at the end here? Look, mission will be costly. Mission will be demanding. Mission might claim everything, our all, even our lives. But friends, it will be worth it. It will be worth it to be known as Jesus is. It will be worth it to be with him for eternity. It will be worth it for the rewards that he grants. And it will be worth it because many, many others will come to faith, including our family and our friends and people in our community and people in our nation and in our world. It'll be worth it. And there will never be a point in 10,000 years, 100,000 years, a million years where you'll go, it wasn't really worth it. You'll never sit there and go, oh, I really wish I didn't take up my cross. You'll never go, oh, I really wish I didn't share the message. You'll really go, I really wish I hadn't put Jesus first. You'll never experience that sense of, it wasn't worth it. It's worth following Jesus. I think, in fact, if there was regret, and I don't think there is regret in heaven, I think it's more likely we'll be in heaven wishing I had done more. I wish I'd followed sooner. I wish I'd been bolder in picking up the cross in other areas of my life much quicker. I wish I had been just quicker to pray more and say more about Jesus to those who I love. I imagine that's going to be much more the case than ever thinking, was it worth it? Because friends, it is. The King has told us it is. The thing is though, do you believe it? And if you believe it, will you take up your cross and follow? Both on mission and as a true disciple.